Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here. Another episode of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Six listeners can't be wrong. Today, our amazing guest, he can save you from biofilm, but if he can't save you from biofilm, then his massive traps and lats can save you from a burning fire. It's Dr. Michael Ruscio. Doc, how are you doing?
Hey, Rob. I'm good. How are you doing, buddy?
Good. We're battling really stellar internet connection, but we've set the bar low with the Paleo Solution Podcast as far as recording sound quality. So we'll just run with what we get today. So,
yeah, crossing my fingers, absolutely.
Absolutely. So you, Doc pinged me maybe a week or two ago, said that he has some super juicy stuff related to inflammatory bowel disease. Let's climb into the bowel and see what's going on here.
Let's have a look. something I've noticed over the past couple of years over time, I've kind of honed in on this issue. There's always patients that don't seem to respond really well to the work of a clinician does. So, you know, every clinician kind of has their own workup, their own method that they work through. And no matter how good you are, there's always going to be a response curve, right? Some people are going to respond awesome. The majority of people are going to respond well. And then you're going to have, you know, some people that also don't respond very well. Yeah. And it's always frustrating. Me being a recovering OCD perfectionist, tendencies are still in the back of my mind. So I really kind of ruminate on the people who are non-responders. And one of the things that I've noticed as I've kind of expanded the workup that I do for these patients, I've started to include antibody screenings for inflammatory bowel disease. And some of these are fairly new, but there's these ASCA antibodies. I think we talked about this last time, which are anti-Saccharomyces cerevisiae antibodies, which is one of the components that screens for Crohn's. And there's these PANCA antibodies that screens for ulcerative colitis. And there's actually a little more to it than just those two, but those two are kind of initial screenings. But blah, blah, blah. Long story short, what I've noticed is in some people who haven't responded to anything else, they've actually had inflammatory bowel disease that has not ever been really diagnosed. And so what I think happens is let's say we take John. John's like our example patient. John's got a lot of gut issues going on. He's really feeling terrible, gas, bloating, oscillations between constipation, diarrhea, or maybe just diarrhea predominated, feels ill often when he eats. And he goes on the paleo diet. He sees a 70% improvement in how he's feeling. Then he maybe goes on a probiotic regimen, maybe some prebiotics along with that, maybe some resistant starch. He gets himself to 80% resolution. Maybe he pops in, sees a funk med doc, does a workup for a gastrointestinal parasite, gets treated for the parasite, and now he's, 90% resolution, something like that. But he's still not able to get to that next step. Well, what I've noticed in a few patients is these patients have actually had inflammatory bowel disease, but they've never really figured it out because they've been managing it so successfully with diet, with probiotics and maybe some functional medicine interventions. And to some extent, it almost doesn't really matter if we're making the diagnosis or not, because we're kind of just naming a disease. But it may matter to some extent because there's this pattern of inflammatory bowel disease that is relapsing and remitting. So it'll go into remission for a while, then patients can relapse and have a flare. And then if it's bad enough, people will need some kind of anti-inflammatory medication to put it back into remission. And so as I've been noticing this, we've been using some herbal anti-inflammatories to try to treat these patients. Because when you look at inflammatory bowel disease, it's usually treated with anti-inflammatory medications, tumor necrosis factor alpha inhibitors, or other stronger biologics. And they work well to suppress the inflammatory response, but the stronger they get, the worse the side effect profiles get. And the side effect profiles can be really, really bad. And so, yes, they work, but they almost create as much damage as they prevent on the other end.
Right.
So I've been looking into the literature on this, and there's some studies that compare the efficacy of herbal anti-inflammatories to placebo. And these studies have shown that the intervention with the herbal anti-inflammatories is superior to placebo. But that's not like the strongest data in the world, because with inflammatory bowel disease, a lot of this stuff is subjective. There's a very large percentage of improvement that you could attribute to placebo. And so while it's nice to show that the herb is better than placebo, what would be really nice is to have a direct head-to-head comparison of a drug to an herbal anti-inflammatory. And that's actually a paper that I recently came across. There was this researcher who had published a number of studies looking at the placebo versus the herbs. And I reached out to this researcher and I said, is there anything available looking at a head-to-head on the herb versus the drug? And he sent me a few great papers, but one was a meta-analysis, and it's entitled Comparison of the Efficacy and Tolerability of Herbal Medicines with 5-aminosalicylates in inflammatory bowel disease, a meta-analysis of placebo-controlled trials involving 812 patients. Hmm. And it was published in 2013. And what is really cool about this is they looked at mesalazine, which is one of the first drugs that will be administered for mild to moderate inflammatory bowel disease. And they looked at mesalazine, which is just an anti-inflammatory, against different herbs. Some of the herbs were Andrographis, Boswellia, and they also had
I lost you there for a second. Yeah. I lost you for about 30 seconds right after the Boswellia.
So in this study, they looked at Boswellia, Andrographis, and essentially psyllium. It's called Plantago in the study. That's just the biogenical name for psyllium. And you kind of have to work to tease some of this out. But when they compared, they compared with what's called a relative risk analysis. And are people familiar with that, Rob? Or should I give a quick preface on that?
I would give a preface on that, yeah.
So relative risk is essentially you take data, you plug it into these 2x2 tables, and you're essentially trying to compare the treatment that you're studying compared to another treatment. The treatment may be a drug. The treatment may be people who don't do something. Like you may look at smokers versus non-smokers, or in this case, we're looking at the herb compared to the drug. And so when you perform the relative risk analysis, if it's a 1, that means the herb worked as effectively as the drug. If it's anything above a 1, it favors the intervention, which in this case is the herb. If it's anything below 1, under 1, it favors the control, which in this case is the drug. So again, anything above 1 favors the herb in this herb to drug comparison. And so looking at clinical remission, the relative risk was 1.28, which is a significant favorability toward the herb. Now, I would say it's not a hugely significant difference, but still, it's a slight, it's slightly favoring the herb for inducing clinical remission. Mm-hmm. Looking at clinical response, the relative risk was 1.19. So again, slightly favoring the herb. That was also considered significant. Endoscopic remission was 0.85, so that slightly favored the drug. But endoscopic response was 1.14, slightly favoring the herb. And so I won't bore you with all the details of this, but the big picture is that the general finding was that the herbs were about, if not slightly, but not always considered statistically significant, more effective than the drugs.
And generally with lower side effects, possibly?
The adverse events were actually very low. There was a few reports that where people reported some kind of gastrointestinal distress with Andrographis. Andrographis, at least according to this meta-analysis, appeared to be the one herb that may have the higher likelihood of a reaction, which is why I would recommend that people work with someone who understands these herbs, because it may be kind of like a natural version of the drug approach, where you try one drug or one herbal anti-inflammatory, see how well that's tolerated. And if that doesn't work, you can try a different one. And the way that I think it would be most effective to use these things, although this is just kind of my opinion, you would try to use these things to push someone into remission, and then hopefully they wouldn't really need a whole lot of anti-inflammatory ongoing, as long as they had good microbiota health, they had a healthy diet, they were using some probiotics, prebiotics, things like that. So as long as the maintenance care was good, for a lot of patients, it may be sufficient just to use the short course of the herbal anti-inflammatories to try to get this into remission.
Gotcha.
So that's just something for people to think about, because and maybe to kind of paint a little bit more of context to this, I've had a couple of patients where, you know, we've gone a few steps down the road and they've gotten better. Actually, in one patient in particular, they had gotten a little bit better, but really not what I would consider a clinical win. And so they wanted to start doing food allergy testing. This one patient in particular really wanted to do food allergy testing, really wanted to do heavy metal testing. And I had the conversation with the patient, which is, you know, I just haven't found the food allergy testing, even though there are some people who I think would really fight me on this. I really haven't found the food allergy testing to be really very clinically useful, nor have I seen the heavy metal testing. But this patient really, really wanted to do these analyses. She really pushed on me. So I said, oh, okay, you know, I'll do them for you. If it's going to get you to a place where you're going to feel better about everything and you can kind of check that off your list and get past it mentally, I'll order those things for you. So ordered a food allergy profile, came up with a few foods that just kind of seemed just random foods. She avoided those foods for a couple months, no change. Did a heavy metal profile, nothing really significant on that profile. And at the same time that we had ran that profile, I ran the expanded inflammatory bowel disease panel through LabCorp, and we found that she had 3 of 4 of the antibodies that are associated with inflammatory bowel disease positive. And the way that you can score the serology is the more of the antibodies are positive, meaning, you know, 1 of 4 positive, 2 of 4 positive, 3 of 4 positive. So the more that are positive, or the higher the level of the positivity, the more severe the disease activity. And so in her case, this was a form of Crohn's that could form fistulas or strictures. So, you know, it was a fairly intensive form of Crohn's. And I was really happy that we caught that, because what I'd hate to see this patient do is go out there and do more food allergy testing, do some questionable heavy metal detox program, and just burn up a bunch of money with some of these pseudoscience-y interventions that we see in alternative medicine. And I'm not saying that there's no application for food allergy testing or for heavy metal testing, but they're definitely not super well validated yet. And so in my opinion, they seem to kind of be hit or miss for patients. Whereas looking at that evidence compared to you have a fairly severe case of inflammatory bowel disease, of course, that's really the diagnosis and the treatment that we want to kind of focus on. So, you know, I think it can really help some people from getting caught into the black hole of internet, you know, self-treatment diagnosis and right. That sort of thing.
Doc, yeah. What do you feel like, and maybe this is a dumb question, what do you feel like is causing this, say, like in this particular person? Like, so we have this inflammatory process. Is it a dietary factor? Is it low vitamin D? Is it stress? Is it lack of sleep? Is it a little bit of all of those? Like, do you have any sense of what's going on here? Is it more just kind of...
Yeah.
You know, we're at a spot where we can identify some clear pathology, you know, with some blood work, we can identify that they're...
Sure.
You know, yeah. Yeah.
You dropped out a little bit there for a second, Rob, but hopefully you can still hear me.
Yeah, you're still coming through.
Okay, good. Yeah. There's actually, I believe it was the Canadian Journal of Gastroenterology in 2013, they published a review entitled Environment and Inflammatory Bowel Disease. And they've shown that smoking is a risk factor. Hygiene is also a risk factor. So the more siblings you have, it may be protective. Growing up on a farm may be protective. Early colonization with H. pylori and worms may also be protective. And that's something that I want to actually come back to later, which is the hygiene hypothesis. So I want to connect back to that, but definitely a more dirty or maybe like a more paleo type of environment during development has been correlated as a protective factor. And then on the other end, urban living environments are a risk factor. Using non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs is a risk factor. Using Accutane is a risk factor. Antibiotics early in life is a risk factor. Certain dietary issues are a risk factor. Those are a little bit hairy, so I'll leave that for another discussion. But breastfeeding is protective. Northern residence is a risk factor. Ambient air pollution is a risk factor, and stress is a risk factor. So we've got the risk factors pretty well dialed in. And you make an awesome question, which is, you know, I think what you're driving at there is, you know, how can we treat that at the most root cause? And I'm right there with you, which is why I would always recommend people start with diet and lifestyle. So you would try to mind your stress. You would try to not be on any drugs or medications that aren't needed. You would remove, you know, you'd essentially follow the paleo or the autoimmune paleo diet. Maybe you would try the SCD diet to see if that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you may want to get a good gastrointestinal evaluation to see if there are any imbalances in your microflora. And just to do any kind of work you can do to try to tone your immune system as much as possible. And then the last thing that you would do would be to try to manage the process after you've done everything you can with the modifiable factors. Because some of those factors that I listed aren't really modifiable, Rob, right? You can't really go back and colonize yourself with H. pylori before the age of three if you're 33. So you want to do everything you can to put yourself in the best position. And then if there's some shortcomings, that's where I'm trying to give people some information on how they may be able to manage the flares of inflammatory bowel disease after they've done everything else.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Doc, could, you know, there was a recent paper that I think was really good. I did a piece on it, you know, talking about gluten sensitivity. Does gluten sensitivity really exist? And they were hanging a lot more of the issue on FODMAPs and whatnot. And a lot of the discussion around this stuff, which was a really good question, I didn't have a great answer for it at the time. But, you know, when you talk about the hygiene pieces, the question that folks were asking, why is this stuff popping up so much? You know, why are we seeing this now? Or maybe we're just actually looking for this stuff now. You know, there's always that potentiality, but you know, it definitely, you know, more of our population lives in urban centers now. We have more chlorinated water. We definitely do antibiotics mm-hmm. much more robustly. We introduce antibiotics into our food stream. We don't sleep as much, et cetera, et cetera. So we have multiple vectors here that seem to, you know, increase the risk factors for, you know, all of these kind of gut-related issues. And so it may not be any one thing, or it may be different things depending on the person, but we're clearly moving in a direction in general that is increasing the likelihood of later gut problems because, again, you know, possibly low vitamin D levels, maybe a too sterile environment so that the gut doesn't really figure out what's self from non-self and those sorts of things.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I do think it's a huge environmental factor there. And there's also been some studies showing that if they use more ancient forms of wheat, and I can't recall the name of the
biochemical
name,
wheat.
But yeah. 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 They've shown the celiac patients react less strongly, if at all, to those more kind of ancient unadulterated grains. So I think it's twofold, probably more so the environment, but then also just how we've kind of change the grains, and we kind of have like a monoculture of, you know, we have like one kind of grain everybody eats instead of having the natural diversity that used to occur.
And you know, something that I've thought about a bit too, we've increased the gluten content of a lot of foods, you know, like breads and pastries, they add enriched gluten flour to these products because it makes it sticky and doughy and all the stuff that we like about that. And, you know, our food processing facilities, we tend to get a lot of cross-contamination. So whereas before we might have had more localized exposure, lower exposure to these potential gut irritants, now we just maybe have a chronic continuous load.
Yep, absolutely. I agree. So yeah, it's definitely multifactorial. The other thing that I think maybe it's a good time to kind of segue over to it, is, you know, how do we look at this changing environment and how it's affecting our reactivity to multiple things? And one of the things that, I'd like to kind of throw some information out in regard to is the hygiene hypothesis in terms of infections. And this is one of the things that I spoke about at my lecture at PaleoFX. And I did a little video about this in the newsletter that'll go out, I think, next week. And I entitled it Parasites, Friend or Foe. And certainly I don't think I'm the first one to kind of speak to this point, but there's this kind of renaissance about how important a dirty environment is, right? Mm-hmm. And we've talked about that before. But I think we also have to keep in mind that there are other studies that contradict that philosophy. So, for example, while it's certainly been noted that as the incidence of measles and mumps infections and rheumatic fever infection has gone down, we've seen things like multiple sclerosis and Crohn's and asthma increase. So as there's been less infections, there's been more autoimmune diseases, so to speak. And there's definitely other evidence that supports that same line of thinking, like the H. pylori, for example. If you're colonized by H. pylori early in life, that protects you from irritable bowel disease later in life. But there are also, looking at H. pylori, there are also things that contradict that. In patients with gastric carcinoma, the eradication of H. pylori helps protect against atrophy scores and intestinal metaplasia. So treating H. pylori in some helps with gastric cancer. Other studies have shown, while there's not many, there's an Italian study I reviewed not too long ago, have shown that when they treat patients with Hashimoto's, when they treat patients who have Hashimoto's and have an H. pylori infection, when they treat them and eradicate H. pylori, the level of thyroid autoimmunity decreases. So, you know, we see these contraindicating things. And another study in the American Journal of Gastroenterology found that antibiotic therapy may induce remission of Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. But that's also a risk factor for Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. So, you know, how do we put together these very contradictory findings? I think what it really has to do with is timing and with context. And we kind of talked about this a little bit the first time I came on the show. And it has to do with that immunodevelopmental window, which seems to kind of seal itself at about age 3. So, you know, it appears that colonization by most bacteria, viruses, worms, most of these microbes, if it occurs before the age of 3, are actually protective. But if it occurs after 3, that's when these things can be a little bit more deleterious. And interestingly, the gut microbiota, that also tends to kind of stabilize at about the age of 3. So what's probably happening is that your colonization window, you have till about 3 to get the colonization in there, and then the immune system doesn't seem to be very plastic at that point in time, and these things can go from being beneficial and kind of colonizing you, and then after the age of 3, you may look at it more like they're infecting you. The other part of this is also the context. So timing and context are the two key things that I think are involved here. Context would mean, do you have good microbial diversity to begin with? Because it seems that the more diverse your colonization is, the more you can tolerate additional colonizers, if you will, if that's even a word.
Sure.
So if you have good diversity, and then the other thing is your genetics. Some that have very strong inflammatory and immune responses may be more prone to having a issue with late colonization compared to those that have a more mild immune response. So it's kind of context and genetics, and not to be too long-winded here, but I wanted to share a few details to kind of reinforce that. But before I get really long-winded, you any like questions on that? Anything you wanted to add in, Rob?
No, that sounds fantastic, and it just makes me think about like some of the predispositions for celiac disease are actually an enhanced immune response. And so some of these folks
exactly.
that tend to have celiac disease, they actually tend to have lower rates of chronic gastrointestinal infections. But so, you know, these are the folks that, early adaptations to living in proximity with other humans and other animals. And so you've got an upside there with being able to fight off potential pathogenic load. But then if something goes wrong, then that enhanced immune response can clearly go south on us.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I mean by kind of the immunogenetics context piece, which is depending on what type of person you are, exactly, you may have this really strong overzealous inflammatory response, or you may be okay. So yeah, it's a great point. And that's what I think it's important, because I look at this information in the clinic, and especially as I've seen more of this hygiene hypothesis information surface, I really kind of question what I'm doing. And I'm saying, well, I spend so much of my day testing for and treating infections, and am I making the problem worse? You know, and that was a legitimate reflection that I had. And I really kind of paused and I said, geez, you know, am I making things worse? And then I said, well, it can't, because I went through all these specific patient cases in my head. You know, this patient got so much better from treating Blastocystis hominis. This patient got so much better from treating Giardia. This patient got so much better from treating X, Y, or Z. So, and then I started to think about it more and more, and I started to go into the literature, and that's when I figured out that it's the timing piece that I think is really, really important. I'll treat people for infections and they will get a lot better. And while there's no way for me to know for sure, what I'm assuming has happened is people have had late colonization or infection. They've had that infection late in life, and now that infection, instead of being protective, is contributing to disease.
Right. Which, you know, it's kind of funny, like on the evidence-based medicine piece, you know, we kind of want these, black and white answers, and the when you start getting like a time criticality to all this, it gets really difficult in my mind to really construct like the classic evidence-based medicine story around this, at least in a very linear fashion. It also gets difficult to educate the masses about this. You know, it's something that may be beneficial for a young child, maybe completely different for an adult, or the way that you would want to tackle treatment.
Yeah, it is. It definitely presents challenges, and it's a hard educational piece, I think, but I think you're the guy for that, right? You're the man to sway the minds and hearts of the population, right? I'll put that one on you.
Thank you. I just posted on my Facebook page the story of Sisyphus, the guy that pissed off the gods, and he got to push a rock up a hill, and then the rock would roll over him and roll back down the hill, and he just did that for eternity. And I think that promoting health is very much that process. So I guess it's job security at the minimum. So yeah.
Oh man.
so Doc, this stuff is super interesting. You had a piece also about low carb diets and resistant starch, and potentially that being you made a really strong case that might be an effective route to fat loss and weight loss. Do you want to shift gears and talk a little bit about that? I really liked that. It was something I had been noodling on a little bit, but your video piece on that was fantastic.
Sure. Yeah. I've done a few videos on the whole resistant starch piece, and I'm going to try to do one or two more to kind of, because it was a lot of data. It was very, very like meticulous, like through the data. And I'm going to try to do one more that kind of brings it home to some concluding remarks. But I think the long story short of it is, it seems like it's clearly been shown that people who go on low carb diets are going to potentially do damage to their microflora and their butyrate production. And that's been shown in study after study after study. But the important piece is how you define a low carb diet from a moderate carb diet. And that is not consistent between studies. The labels are not consistent between studies. So you really have to look at the grams of ingestion of carbohydrate compared to the effect it has on GI function. And what it seems like is when people are at 25, 30 grams of carbs a day, they are definitely going to be doing some damage because I don't think
definitely
it's
some
damage,
pruning
but
of the microflora.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great term. Yeah. So you will see certain population number counts go down, and you will see production of short chain fatty acids like butyrate go down. When you get to around, and it's hard to say because you kind of have to draw a little bit of an inference from looking at the studies on this, but when you get to around maybe 125, 150 grams a day, I would say definitely if you're consistently below 100, you know, that's where it seems where you hit the bend, meaning if you're above 100, you're probably okay. Definitely if you're at 150 grams a day has clearly been shown to not cause any significant reduction in these bacterial populations or in short chain fatty acids. So definitely if you're at 150, you're okay. If you're at 100, you're kind of on the cusp. And things that have been shown, different bacterial populations like Eubacterium rectalis, one that's been studied. Another one is the Roseburia species. Bifidobacter has also been looked at. These are kind of like three of the populations that are most well studied, and you see consistent decreases in these populations. Interestingly, the Fecal Bacterium prausnitzii, which is also a butyrate producer and has been associated with inflammatory bowel disease, specifically Crohn's, lower levels of this Fecal Bacterium prausnitzii has been associated with increased Crohn's activity. That actually may get better on a low carbohydrate diet. So it seems that it's not all bad by going on a low carb diet, but there are certainly some bad things that happen. The good news is, though, is by using either fiber supplementation, prebiotic supplementation, or resistant starch supplementation, you can reverse these changes in decreased numbers of these good bacteria, and you can help increase your output of short-chain fatty acids. So I think everyone's heard about resistant starch at this point in time. Everyone's probably heard about fiber and probiotics, but what I'd like to add that may be new information is a lot of the studies will look at type 2, 3, and 4 resistant starch. And sometimes what happens is someone will see a finding showing that this study showed that this bacterial population was increased by resistant starch. But you have to read more closely because sometimes that is resistant starch type 3 or 4. And people aren't really able to readily supplement with that. It's really the type 2 that is in like the Bob's Red Mill
potato
tapioca
starch
or corn starch or potato starch. Exactly. It's not the 3 or 4. The 3 would be formed, you cook a potato, it cools, and then you eat it. But people aren't going to be getting a lot of that in, or most people aren't going to be getting a lot of type 3 because it does come with a decent bolus of carbohydrate along with it. And then type 4 is a byproduct of a chemical process. So people aren't going to be getting much type 4 either. So you really have to look at the benefit you can derive from type 2. And while this is a bit of a contentious issue, it looks like bifidobacteria is not strongly fed by type 2 resistant starch. And I've pulled a few papers on this, and it does not seem like you get a strong bifidobacteria response. You do from 3 and 4, but not so much from 2. But that's where something like inulin or fructooligosaccharides or even just some of these soluble and insoluble fiber blends seem to work really well, which is why I recommend using a combination of, and this is for people, this is not for everyone. This is for people who either have gut issues or people who are on low carbohydrate diets who are trying to prevent any pruning, as you say, Rob. I would recommend a combination of a low dose prebiotic, a soluble insoluble fiber blend, along with some resistant starch. And I think that's going to be the best way to cover your bases. And it's, if you think about it for a second and we just kind of zoom out, it's just kind of coming back to the concept of try to have variety in your diet.
Right.
So in this case, it's instead of eating one vegetable every day, you know, resistant potato starch, you're going to try to eat a number of vegetables, resistant starch, fiber, and a prebiotic mixture.
Doctor, so if you were to order out some foods, what would be your favorites on the resistant starch story and any caveats with their preparation? You know, like if people are game for cooking some potatoes ahead of time and then letting them cool down, or, you know, like they cook some fried potatoes one night for dinner and then they, you know, they're like, okay, I'm going to save some of these and have them for breakfast and cool them off. Like some of the stuff I've read about rice, it actually needs to be frozen to be able to really increase the resistant starch content. The parboiled rice is better than, say, like basmati rice. Like, do you have some recommendations on the food side of that? And then also maybe is there a close to a one-stop shop on the mixed fiber prebiotic that you would recommend? Are there any products out there that you would recommend?
Well, in terms of the resistant starch, I can't say I haven't found anything definitive in that regard just yet. It's something I'm currently researching, and I've spent most of my time thus far just trying to establish what role they play with the microflora. And that part I think I've got a good handle on. The next thing I'm trying to establish, and this is something that I've seen too many conflicting things and there's too many unanswered questions for me to feel comfortable making a recommendation just yet. But the next thing I'm trying to do is trying to come up with a recommendation of, you know, this would be the one or two things I would recommend to cover all your bases. In short, I think a mixture of some kind of fiber would be a good idea. I use a fiber product from Moss Nutrition called Fiber Select, which is just a blend of soluble and insoluble fiber. I use that along with Biotigen in the clinic, which is from Claire Labs. And then I've been going a little bit away from the corn and potato starch and trying to go a little more toward the tapioca. Just because I'm trying to avoid the ones that may be kind of non-autoimmune friendly, so to speak.
Gotcha.
And there's another one I just came across. It's a mixture of root vegetables, and the name of it is escaping me right now. But that's another one I'm going to be kind of experimenting with. So sorry not to have a super, you know, conclusive recommendation, but I'm working on it right now. So bear with me.
No, that's great. That makes an argument for bringing you back. So that's no problem on that. Green bananas, parboiled rice that's maybe been cooled, some potatoes, although with the potatoes, some of the autoimmune considerations, maybe a caveat, is there anything else that's kind of some low-hanging fruit that, you know, I don't think that most people really thought about, like green bananas, for example, that was a pretty, and I would argue that from a glycemic load, carbohydrate load standpoint, green bananas are maybe a better bet than a lot of these other options, right? As far as
exactly, and that's the challenging thing. It's for me, for people who are not carbohydrate sensitive, this is an easy one. Just eat a variety, right? And you don't really have to worry too much. If you're not carb sensitive, you don't have to worry about the carb content. But the thing that's more challenging for me is trying to find the ones that are non-allergenic and are also low carb. And that's the challenging piece, is trying to find the ones that fit all of those components. I've looked around for the plantain flour, but I'm still not, it still seems like it's a hit or miss, meaning, you know, is this plantain flour? Is it compared to, like, there's not really like a green plantain flour, and sometimes it's flour or it's starch, because you don't want to have the flour, you want to have the starch. So That's why I say there's a few unanswered questions in that regard for the low carb people. So I think you'd have like I said with the fiber, with the prebiotic I mentioned, and then one of these forms of maybe like tapioca or corn or potato starch, if you tolerate it, I think you'd be okay. But with some of the other ones, I'm still trying to figure out what the carb to starch or fiber ratio is with some of those things. So jury's still out.
Cool. Well, that's all the stuff I've been tinkering with. Green bananas, more potatoes, trying to eat some of the potatoes cooled. I'm still trying to figure out. I just hope somewhere along the line that purple sweet potatoes have some resistant starch somewhere, because those things are like eating chocolate cake. Those are totally amazing. So I keep hoping that they have some resistant starch in them. But maybe that, you know, that's another point that, you know, when people have tried steering the boat towards a lower carb side of things, if the whether you're talking about Mike Eads or Lauren Cordain, or I mean, even, you know, back in the kind of Atkins days, when you really got back to the core recommendations, it was get as much of that stuff from whole unprocessed foods, fruits, vegetables, you know, low glycemic load carbohydrate sources. And possibly part of the problem migrating away from that is the person is limiting carbohydrates, hoping to, you know, blunt some insulin response or something like that. But then inadvertently, all that they're doing is, if they're eating refined carbohydrates, even though it's a relatively small amount, they're starving the colonic bacteria and potentially exacerbating or creating a situation of a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is another, you know, here again on the education side, it's like possibly limit the carbs, although you need to be really careful about not only how much you limit it, but the types that you limit.
Exactly. And, yeah. It doesn't seem to me like, it seems like a lot of people are actually kind of cruising in around like maybe like, you know, between 1 and 200 a day. It doesn't seem like there's a ton of people who have to do, you know, sub 100 grams a day indefinitely.
Right.
And remember, if you're getting around that 125, 150 grams a day from just a mix of sources, then you're okay. Then you can kind of just shut your brain off and go and live life and right. be happy. Not like, you know, obsess over this.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Very cool. Doc, anything else?
One or two things. I made a note of this and I wanted to mention this. There's one of the things, of course, I see in practice is sometimes it's not that I have to give a patient something in practice, is I have to get them to stop taking so much stuff. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you'll see in some of the more medical based gastroenterology literature is that they call it a drug holiday. And what they do is they will not re-up a prescription for a patient. They will wait 2 weeks before re-upping a prescription for a patient to put them on this drug holiday to establish if the patient actually really needs the drug. And that's something I do in the clinic. I don't call it that, but what I try to do, as soon as a patient is feeling better, I start to take them off the things that I have in their therapeutic program. Hmm. And the dialogue we'll have is, okay, you seem to be doing pretty good right now. We're going to take you off of these herbs that help balance out your female hormones. And let me know if you notice a regression in all your improvements, and then we can put you back on it. But my approach is to try to get people to try to do an intensive window of therapies and then get them off as much stuff as possible. But I think sometimes you hear about all these people talking about this is good for that and that is good for this and yada, yada, yada. And some of the patients that come into me are literally on like 15 to 20 things, and that's really not healthy. And so what I'd like to challenge, you know, the people listening with is try doing a supplement holiday and try going off of a supplement for 2 weeks and see if you notice a regression, any kind of regression, but a regression specific to what that supplement's supposed to help. And if you don't, then you may not need it. And the reason why I make that recommendation is because a lot of these things aren't meant to be used in the long term. And so you can potentially be doing some damage when you take a lot of supplements long term. So that's just one thing I want to throw out there for people, FYI. Of course, if you have some kind of condition, you're taking something under a doctor's supervision, don't do any of this without okaying it with them. But if you have things you're self-prescribing yourself, try a periodic supplement holiday and see if you still feel okay. And if you do, you've probably repaired whatever the underlying issue is, and you probably don't really need to be taking stuff, and you can just focus on food and lifestyle and just enjoy yourself and save that money.
So the 50 kilos of potato starch that I have, I may need to convert into vodka at this point.
Well, you'd probably be pretty fun if you did, Rob.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think that's our I keep saying when I'm done selling health, it's going to be hookers, cocaine, and booze. So that's where the potato starch is going. No, that's a great advice. And, you know, I've had really good success putting in some things like the potato starch. And but, you know, I it had not occurred to me to phase that out and just see if relying on food was going to produce the same benefits for me. So that had never even occurred to me. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think what happens with some people is they hear about whatever the thing that was in vogue like 3 years ago. They hear about that and they go on it. And then a few months later, something else is in vogue. And then a few months later, something else is in vogue. And so you just accrue all this stuff.
Right.
And you just, you know, and yeah, so just hopefully some people will just try to kind of curtail what they're doing, because if nothing else, I mean, you can just save yourself some money and use that money for booze, hookers, and cocaine. You
exactly.
Know?
Yeah. Buy the Ruscio Wolf potato starch vodka, you know, it'll be like $100 a bottle or something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Coming soon.
Yeah, coming soon to a broken down you know 7-Eleven near you. Perfect.
So Rob, I don't know how much more time we have, but I had a couple tidbits on SIBO, and then a couple tidbits on gastroparesis. If we've got a little bit more
jump
time,
into it. Let's do it. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I guess I'll start off with SIBO. You know, I really have to give Dr. Seibecker and Dr. Pimentel a hearty hat tip, because they were kind of the two keynote people at the recent symposium on SIBO, and just a lot of great stuff. So I just really want to thank them for all the great information that they put out. Some of the things that I've come across from the SIBO symposium, and then from incorporating some of that stuff into the clinic, I am now using the National College of Naturopathic Medicine's SIBO analysis. I really, really like it. I had been using Genova in the past, and again, hopefully I won't get any hate mail from Genova, but I have to say that the National College of Naturopathic Medicine's Quintron breath test for SIBO just seems to be a much better test, and I'm getting results that seem to fit the clinical picture much more closely. So that's been really helpful in making my life easier. And also, they do have an insurance billing option too. It's only a $155 test to begin with, so it's not very expensive, but you know, functional medicine can get expensive very quick if you're not trying to keep the cost low. So I try to really cut costs wherever I can. So this being a good test, A, and having insurance billing option B, has been great. Yeah, and something else regarding SIBO, and this was presented by Dr. Pimentel. It's what he's kind of currently researching right now and has been researching for the past several years. But there's this entity known as post-infectious IBS. I'm sure you've heard of that, Rob. It's, you know, someone has a bout of gastroenteritis, throwing up diarrhea, what have you, and then they have IBS symptoms that persist after that. So post-infectious IBS is a recognized clinical entity. What Dr. Pimentel has done is he's actually identified some of the mechanisms that are happening under the hood during that. And what it appears happens is certain infections, certain gastrointestinal bugs will cause a release of this, what's called cytolethal distending toxin, or CDT. And CDT can actually cross-react with glial cells or nerve cells in the lining of the gut, and actually also attack another tissue known as viculin, which can essentially cause essentially causes autoimmunity against gastrointestinal tissues that interferes with peristalsis, or it's also known as the migratory motor complex. Hmm. And why this is important is these things can all potentiate SIBO. SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, is found in upwards of 80% of patients with IBS. And what actually may happen is when it's post-infectious IBS, people have a gut infection. That gut infection causes autoimmunity against gastrointestinal tissue. And then you no longer have the proper ability of the muscular layer in the intestines to contract, to push food through. And when food does not get pushed through, it becomes stagnant. And it's kind of like stagnant water fosters bacteria. Well, stagnant food also fosters bacteria. And so then you have SIBO.
Interesting. How long?
So the underlying mechanism may be autoimmune in short.
In the short term. And for most people, that's going to resolve within a couple of weeks. But this could also be a lot of my problems. I think I had some low-grade GI problems throughout my whole life. I never really tolerated dairy that well. I don't think I tolerated wheat that well. But it wasn't until I had actually a Giardia infection in my mid-20s that the wheels just completely fell off the wagon. And I was never really the same after that. It's only been, I would say honestly, maybe the last 9 months to a year when I've been playing with resistant starch, doing some homeostatic soil organisms via Prescriptassist and a couple of other outfits, that I would say, similar to that guy where it's like, okay, 70%, 80%, like I was in that 80 to 90% range for a long time. And I feel like this last little piece has kind of, 95, close to 100% there, like my digestion, I'm pooping like a teenager again, but it was a super gnarly case of Giardia, which ended up going misdiagnosed the first round when I went in to get like an ova and parasite. And I ended up losing 35, almost 40 pounds. I was basically like chronic wasting disease by the time we really figured this thing out. So I had a really long-standing, very active infection, which has taken me almost, 15 going on 20 years to really get back to the health I had before that.
Sure, yeah. So you what probably happened with you, Rob, is, and again, I don't know everything, but you probably had this post-infectious kind of IBS, and really what was probably happening underneath the surface was SIBO. And over time with your healthy diet, lifestyle, and using other pro and prebiotics, you probably just kind of successfully rebalanced yourself.
Right. 20 years of balancing. It's been awesome. But I never had
journey, right?
I never had a Dr. Ruscio to figure this stuff out with me. I largely cobbled this together. The knowledge that we have on these topics today, most of the people who read, follow your website, read my blog, they have so much more information than most of the top level clinicians had 10 years ago. It's pretty remarkable.
Oh yeah, it really is amazing. In the office I work, there's another doctor that kind of does predominantly some weight loss stuff. And I remember a patient came in that listens to your podcast to see him, and he referred her to me, and he pulled me aside. He's like, I'm afraid to even talk to this patient. She's way too freaking smart.
Well, it's hard as hell to stay up on stuff. Like other folks, they'll bounce around to Cresser's blog, your blog, Stefan Guyonnet's blog, and all of a sudden, they've got questions and understanding that I'm kind of like, I don't know, maybe you should be running this show. I'm ready to check out. You can take over the reins of this thing. But it's super cool in a lot of ways. It can be challenging too, because like you said, there's a tendency of getting in and doing a lot of self-diagnosis, but without the right lab work at the right time and being able to really have an objective kind of measure for, okay, is this working? Is it not working? Then you can spend a lot. You can spin your wheels for a long time.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I did. I spent months and months treating what I thought was hypothyroid and low testosterone with all these herbs and other things. And, if I had just stuck with my clinician and gone back to them for a follow-up and gotten retested, I would have, you know, I would have gotten through it a lot more quickly. So, yeah, sometimes it's better just to go with someone objective. You know, there's that old saying, the, how does it go?
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing. Yeah. The doctor treats himself as a fool as a patient.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Doc, you've got a new podcast coming out here soon, right?
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me about that. I'm trying to get a podcast going here, and I'm planning on launching it within the next few months. Essentially, the way I'm looking to set up the podcast is just going to be half of me just kind of rambling on about all the research and reading that I'm doing, because there's so much great stuff I come across. I want to get more of the information out to people, and I don't have the time to do a video or an article about everything that I come across. So I figure this would be a way for me to kind of leverage my ability to get information out there. So the first half will be all just sharing information and stuff that I've noticed in the clinic and all that kind of thing. And then the other half will be kind of a Q&A where people can call in or write in with questions. But I'm looking for a host. So if people want to apply to become the host, they can go to tiny.cc/DrRusho, DrRusCIO. That's tiny.cc/DrRusho. And they'll see an application there and instructions for taking the next step.
Very cool. And Doc, just make sure to ping that to Squatchy, and we'll get it in the show notes too.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, Doc, it's always fantastic having you on. Anything else that people need to think about, you know, until our next installment of gut-related fun?
One quick thing on gastroparesis that I wanted to touch on. Gastroparesis is a condition where people will have a lot of nausea, a lot of throwing up. They feel like their stomach gets full really easily. And what can happen is they can have partial paralysis of the muscles in the lining of the stomach that contract and push the food into the small intestine. And it seems like these people don't really have a ton of great options, because the drugs that are used to treat it are called prokinetics, but some of them can have a pretty hefty side effect profile. There's actually been a few studies looking at ginger as a prokinetic, actually a few human trials. And while they are not the largest, you know, most impressive trials in the world, there is some data suggesting that ginger may be a pretty effective prokinetic, which would help people with this condition of gastroparesis. And then something else that people can do to try to kind of self-diagnose at home to see if they do have this condition, gastroparesis, if food is liquefied, then there doesn't seem to be an issue with emptying the gastric contents. So if people for a couple of days were to, and I know this doesn't sound like the most attractive thing in the world, but if they were to blend up and liquefy their food and they noticed they got markedly better, that would tell them that they probably have gastroparesis at the cause of their nausea, vomiting, and stomach bloating. And so that may just kind of help get them on the right path. And like I said, ginger can be used, but you have to be careful, because you can't just use any kind of herb. Curcumin actually seems to make gastroparesis worse. My thinking was, well, ginger is an anti-inflammatory. What about other anti-inflammatories? And so I went into PubMed and I pulled up some papers on curcumin, and actually makes can make gastroparesis worse or delay stomach emptying. So you have to be careful with that. And then also butyrate supplementation foods that feed butyrate may also make gastroparesis worse. So just a few kind of tidbits there on gastroparesis, if there's people out there who are suffering with those symptoms.
Doc, any quick sense of what is maybe an underlying cause with the gastroparesis, or maybe the primary factors there?
Well, a large part of gastroparesis is known to be idiopathic, meaning that we don't know. Second to that would be diabetic gastroparesis, So when people have diabetes, high blood sugar can cause inflammation and damage to nervous tissue. And so diabetes is probably the most well-known cause. And then there's also this phenomenon known as, which is much, much lesser of an issue, post-viral gastroparesis, which may kind of be similar to the post-infectious IBS.
Interesting.
Right? Where these infections, I'm speculating there a little bit, but that's an option. And then also if people have some kind of gastric bypass or other kind of gastric surgery, then gastroparesis can be a complication of one of those procedures.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, it doesn't make it's not hugely surprising that, you know, one form of infection, depending on the tissues affected and the location in the GI tract, might lead to IBS type symptoms. It might, be kind of almost a loose stool kind of manifestation, whereas the other one would be more gastroparesis, vomiting, and feeding into some small intestinal bacterial overgrowth type stuff because the food isn't really moving through at the right rate. I mean, it's just it when you think, and again, you know, it's speculative, but it's not entirely surprising that a similar or even same kind of causative mechanism may affect things differently depending on the location and the person and whatnot, which again complicates the clinical picture quite a bit.
Exactly, it's the the gut issues are kind of the pinnacle of practice, I think, because they're the most rewarding, but they're also the most challenging in some cases. So, I guess that's just the gut for you. It's a mixed bag.
We need to do some genetic engineering and just get chloroplasts, and we'll just start making food from the sun, and everybody moves to the equator, and we'll be good. So,
what else we could do? Have you seen the movie The Internship, where they talk about being struck down into guys who could fit into a blender, and then when they get out of the blender, they're going to go into a little mini submarine and go inside your body and help fight disease. Did you see that?
Yeah. Oh, I like
so
that.
So we could shrink down, Rob, and we could just do an hourly rate gig where we'll just go inside someone's bloodstream and just fight pathogens.
I say that we start that company and shrink other people. That's my vote on that. But
yeah, that's a good idea. I'm already small enough. I can't afford to lose anymore.
There you go. Well, Doc, it was great having you on again, and we'll get that link up for prospective show hosts. And you said again, maybe a couple of months out on your podcast.
Yeah, a couple of months out. I'm working on it. It's contingent upon my new website, which has been an absolute train wreck trying to get that thing up and going. So as soon as I get a competent web developer who can actually finish the site will be done, and the podcast will be on the heels of that.
Sweet. Well, I mean, you live near Silicon Valley. I guess everybody's working on Twitter and Facebook, and nobody does websites anymore. So,
yeah, exactly. Or I just have terrible luck with finding someone. But yeah, and then the only other thing going on is I'll be at AHS this year, speaking all on the gut. So that should be cool. It's up at UC Berkeley this year, right in my backyard.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, that one I unfortunately will not be attending because I'll probably be changing a second round of diapers about that time. So I'll miss seeing you there, but folks definitely should get in on that, particularly if you're on the West Coast. The travel's a whole lot easier. I guarantee you that.
Absolutely. Well, cool, Rob. Thanks for having me on, and hopefully people got some good information that they can use from the call.
Oh, guaranteed. And we'll look forward to having you on again.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Awesome, Doc. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.